Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're going to be reading from Vanity Fair Online. We still haven't gotten that paper copy. I think March will be the first one of the year. So today we're going to be starting with an article about Kobe Bryant. Then we're going to go to the Harvey Weinstein trial and probably some impeachment news if we've got some time at the end. So this is In Memoriam, Remembering Kobe Bryant, Omnipresent Basketball Force. For the better part of two decades, Bryant was what you thought about when you thought about basketball. This is by Dan Adler, and it was published on January 27th. For most of his two-decade career in the NBA, Kobe Bryant was the player to watch. It wasn't just the talent, which there was in spades, but the manner in which it manifested and so often was emulated. Much was made of his will and worth ethic. The Black Mamba was a competitive alter ego whose name he chose himself, but despite the reputation, he didn't always carry himself on the court quite so single-mindedly. Today, nearly 4 years after his retirement, the in-game Bryant silhouette is unforgettable. Loose, expressive, unpredictable, until the essential moment when he was thrillingly decisive. Silky dribbles, all eyes on me, isolation plays, and unguardable fadeaways were the stock in trade. So he scored well, so well that it was only on Saturday night at LeBron James that LeBron James passed Bryant as the third leading scorer in league history. James did it as a member of the Los Angeles Lakers, the only team Bryant ever played for in his 20-year career. Bryant, writing with the voice of an elder statesman he'd come to inhabit at 41, marked the occasion on Twitter. "Continuing to move the game forward," Bryant wrote to James. The timing of that torch passing made the shocking news Sunday that Bryant had died in a helicopter crash outside Los Angeles alongside his 13-year-old daughter Gianna, a thriving basketball talent herself, and seven others all the more incomprehensible. He was just here. And owing to a professional basketball life that began out of high school, for the current crop of NBA players and fans, he had seemingly always been. The accolades became so frequent and so expected that they now almost register as a footnote when thinking about Bryant's career. 5 NBA championships, 1 Most Valuable Player Award, 2 Finals MVPs, 18 All-Star appearances. And then there were the intangibles, his chemistry with Shaquille O'Neal, and then his friction with him. The unmissable, as in this alley-oop, a play at the center of one of those championships. He jumped over an Aston Martin in a commercial. It was fake, but it hardly mattered. In 2009, he made it clear to Shane Battier that he couldn't be guarded, so clear that he received a technical for his efforts to edify. His career was not without controversy. In 2003, during the peak of Bryant's career, a 19-year-old hotel employee accused him of raping her while he was in Colorado treating a knee injury. The case was dropped in 2004 when the employee declined to testify, and Bryant publicly apologized, writing, "Although I truly believe this encounter between us was consensual, I recognize now that she did not and does not view this incident the same way I did." A civil case was settled out of court. His life on court continued to flourish. But the case and that apology were the subjects of reviewed scrutiny in recent years, especially when Bryant was nominated for an Oscar that he went on to win in 2018. Outside of a burgeoning entertainment empire, in retirement, Bryant was also becoming a noted mentor to a younger generation of players. For most of the guys in the league, Boston Celtics coach Brad Stevens said on Sunday, Kobe is their Jordan. In a pregame interview, Los Angeles Clippers coach Doc Rivers said the same, to the extent that he could say anything. "Looking at my young players and seeing how emotional they are, they didn't know him," he said through tears. "It just shows you how far his reach was." Within hours of the news breaking, tributes broke out across the sport as "Kobe, Kobe" chants began at scheduled NBA games, but also among other athletes and from politicians, musicians, and more. At the Grammys on Sunday night, held at the Staples Center, the Lakers' home arena, there will be a rushed-together tribute. The Brazilian soccer star, Neymar, held up Bryant's number 24 with his fingers after scoring a goal in Paris. Bryant left behind a legacy that extended well beyond the sport, but it wasn't simply because he delved into entertainment and investment. By the time Bryant aged out of the sport and the sport's prevailing style shifted away from his rigid approach, he'd left too big of an impression to be forgotten. He continued to be present in the league, courtside, but also in its overall texture. The Mamba mentality became a skill to be learned, like a new low post move, or like one of those Bryant fadeaways that will continue to play on loop in the weeks and years to come. All right, on to some Weinstein trial news. This is in the Vanity Fair HWD section. You take on a role, correct? How an actress accuser revealed the true theatrics of the Harvey Weinstein trial. The movie mogul's team has implied that one of his alleged accusers' acting experience makes her an unreliable witness, but the defense team has its own kind of theatrics. This was written on January 27, 2020 by Maureen O'Connor. You're a professional actress, correct? You take on a role, correct? And you convince the audience? Annabella Sciorra had been on the witness stand for close to 2 hours on Thursday when Harvey Weinstein's lawyer, Donna Rotunno, attacked her credibility by invoking her career. Last week, Sciorra became the first woman to accuse Weinstein of rape in a criminal court. On Monday, Mimi Halei took the stand to accuse him of sexual assault. Called to testify at the movie producer's trial for the alleged sexual assaults of two other women, Sciorra wept when she described a forcible rape in 1993, followed by years of stalking and menacing. Weinstein denies this and has pleaded not guilty. The next day, actress Rosie Perez testified about discussing the incident with Sciorra, a friend, in the 90s. Weinstein's defense rests largely on impugning his accuser's credibility. The movie producer maintains that any sexual contact was consensual. His lawyers have offered every possible reason why an accuser would lie and lamented every reason why their testimony will be compelling. During voir dire, defense attorney Damon Chironis asked juries whether they could remain impartial when witnesses were crying. The acting complaint has come up before. 3 weeks prior to Sciorra's testimony, Rotunno speculated on live TV that the Sopranos actress would be an excellent witness on the stand because she spent her entire life acting for a living. Simultaneously, accusatory and dismissive, the comment seemed to ascribe duplicity for Sciorra. But the rhetorical method was itself duplicitous, a superficially benign statement of fact made combative by its context. In court, Sciorra ignored the connotation. You've done very well, haven't you? Rotunno asks of Sciorra's career. Thank you, replied the actress. Sciorra's testimony was dramatic. How could it not be? She was describing events that she says have altered her life. But I wouldn't call it theatrical, except perhaps in the way that anything a celebrity does feels a little bit theatrical to onlookers. The public's fascination with famous people has been an integral and sometimes awkward factor in hashtag MeToo's rise, when it's A-list actors alleging crimes of violence by a powerful Hollywood figure that is going to get attention, feminist lawyer Gloria Allred told me in a recent interview. So I'm glad that they decided to speak out, because there are also others who were then encouraged to do so. Allred represents Halei and Sciorra. Halei's alleged sexual assault in 2006 is one of the two encounters for which Weinstein is being tried. The other involves hairdresser Jessica Mann, who says Weinstein raped her in 2013. In recent weeks, Allred says she came to represent another woman who, like Sciorra, is expected to testify about an alleged pattern of predatory behavior. The first days of testimony at Weinstein's trial were sometimes focused on show business, to an extent that was at times bizarre. A former board member of the Weinstein Company explained that what independent films means at the behest of the prosecution. Rotunno's cross-examination of Sciorra included inquiries about losing weight for roles in Hollywood's three major agencies. Sciorra's weight came up when she described falling into depression post-rape. I have yet to figure out why the defense wanted to rank Hollywood talent agencies, but it is now a matter of public record that Annabella Sciorra thinks the concept that there's only three majors is outdated. In addition to asking Sciorra why she didn't immediately report Weinstein to the police, Rotunno asked why she didn't report him to Sylvester Stallone and Robert De Niro when they were promoting the Weinstein-produced film Copland in 1997. Weinstein's lawyers offer their own form of theatrics for those following the trial. Outside of court, Rotunno is the mouthpiece of Weinstein's legal team. Her incendiary interviews have drawn repeat requests from prosecutors for a gag order, all denied. Rotunno has been known to wear a gold chain necklace that says not guilty and wears 6-inch Ferragamo stilettos in court. Co-counsel Arthur Idala routinely enters and exits the courthouse in a jewel-toned fedora. A former Fox News analyst, his preferred rhetorical style is go for broke. He invoked the presidential impeachment when he moved for a mistrial after opening statements. He invoked the Constitution when he requested a sequestered trial. More than once, Justice James Burke has angrily ordered Idala to sit down, like when the lawyer barreled through objections to question one of Shiora's friends so aggressively that Burke said continuing the cross-examination would be at his own peril. Any trial has its own elements of theater, but this one is delivered more than most, even in the mechanics of observing it. Journalists start lining up outside the courthouse before dawn to claim the limited seats reserved for members of the press at the Weinstein trial. The first 70 receive numbered note cards stamped with the date, which we use as tickets for readmission after lunch and bathroom breaks. Rotunno ended Shiora's cross-examination by playing video of the actress appearing on David Letterman's TV show in 1997. In the video, Shiora jokes about making up stories to entertain herself during press tours. Immediately after, Assistant District Attorney Joan Iluzzi followed up. In this interview and this comedy show, were you talking about, in any way, shape, or form, talking about lying about matters as serious as what we're here for? Shiora replied, absolutely not. You take on a role, correct? Rotunno asked Shiora. And when you play someone in a movie, that role is not you being Annabella Shiora, correct? It's parts of me, she replied. Perhaps some onlookers found the Letterman video damning. What I noticed was how vastly different Annabella Shiora the actress is from Anna Shiora the witness. Though seemingly at ease on Letterman's sofa, she was also performing with every inch of her body. Her smile was dazzling, her laughter was alluring, her hair was flawless, her stories were intriguing. 30 years later, on the witness stand, she seemed exhausted. The story was raw. Her voice was unsteady. She seemed unable to control the sobs that emerged sometimes mid-sentence. If the goal of acting is to speak, move, and communicate in a manner that compels compassion in those who watch, then yes, that might be useful in a courtroom or in any public recitation of a personal story. Who the public listens to and empathizes with and believes, and why, is a large and complex and generally dispiriting topic, but it's also part of #MeToo, isn't it? Weinstein's work to silence and discredit his accusers has also been part of this trial. After Perez's testimony, a private investigator discussed a list Weinstein kept of people he feared would speak out publicly. Annabella Shiora's name was on it. Let's move to the Hive section and a little Facebook news. Facebook to pay millions for allegedly mishandling user data. Again. Facebook reached a $550 million settlement with Illinois users who allege the company improperly collected their biometric data. This is by Allison Durkee, published on January 30th. Facebook's privacy missteps are once again coming with a hefty price tag. Months after the company faced a $5 billion fine from the Federal Trade Commission over its data privacy practices following the Cambridge Analytica scandal, the social media giant revealed Wednesday that it's reached a $550 million settlement in a class action lawsuit over the company's facial recognition software. According to lawyers involved with the suit, the settlement marks the largest cash settlement ever for a privacy-related lawsuit. And though the settlement now has to be approved by the presiding district court, each class member is expected to be compensated at least $200. The lawsuit was brought by Illinois-based Facebook users who alleged that Facebook's tag suggestions feature, which automatically predicts which Facebook users appear in photos, improperly gathered users' biometric facial data without their permission and with no disclosure as to how long the data was being kept. By doing so, Facebook was allegedly in violation of Illinois' biometric privacy law, which is one of the strictest such laws in the country and the only one entitling consumers to monetary damages. Facebook has denied any wrongdoing. The Illinois law has real teeth. It pretty much stopped Facebook in its tracks, Mark Rottenberg, executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, told the New York Times. Tech firms and other companies that collect biometric data must be very nervous right now. By paying a settlement now rather than taking the case to trial, Facebook potentially skirted paying even higher fees, as the Illinois law stipulates that companies can be fined $1,000 to $5,000 each time someone's image is used without consent. Should that have happened in Facebook's case, the company could have had to pay as much as $6 billion, a Bloomberg analysis calculated. The $550 million settlement comes as Facebook has increasingly come under fire for a myriad of practices spanning everything from user privacy and antitrust concerns to its political advertising policy. But the hefty payment is also notable as criticism against facial recognition software throughout the tech sphere continues to escalate. In recent months, critics have decried Amazon's recognition facial software and the use of facial recognition by police, even spurring San Francisco to ban the use of such software by law enforcement entirely. Biometrics is one of the two primary battlegrounds, along with geolocation, that will define our privacy rights for the next generation, attorney Jay Edelson of Edelson PC, one of the lawyers behind the Illinois Facebook suit, said in a statement. And this isn't the first time that Facebook has been targeted for its own facial recognition practices. The company was forced to deactivate the technology for European users in 2012 in response to criticism from regulators and has since updated some of its settings. The company also agreed to provide clear and conspicuous notice of the software and obtain additional permissions as part of its agreements with the FTC. Of course, $550 million is a mere drop in the bucket for Facebook, who reported in their quarterly earnings report Wednesday that their revenue rose to $21 billion in the final quarter of 2019, beating analyst expectations. The company's earnings report also revealed that Facebook's user base had outperformed expectations and rose by 9%. Yet the company's increased expenses, which include the Illinois settlement, and were up 51% from the year prior, still sent the company's stocks tumbling by more than 7% in after-hours trading. The market expects more from Facebook, analyst Melissa Parrish told MarketWatch. Its impressive revenue and user gains just don't seem to be good enough. CEO Mark Zuckerberg remained optimistic in the company's earnings report call, however, and addressed the privacy concerns plaguing Facebook and the steps they're taking in response. It's going to take time, but over the next decade, I want us to build a reputation for privacy that's as strong as our reputation around building good, stable services, Zuckerberg said, pointing to developments like new privacy checkup tools and allocating more than 1,000 engineers to work on privacy-related projects. As the Facebook CEO comes off a year that saw him widely reviled by everyone from Washington, D.C. lawmakers to his own Silicon Valley peers, Zuckerberg also held strong against the criticism that follows both his company and him personally. In his remarks, the CEO emphasized his desire to merely better communicate what he's doing, rather than back down and give in to his critics' demand. "My goal for this next decade isn't to be liked, but to be understood. In order to be trusted, people need to know what you stand for," Zuckerberg said. "These positions aren't always going to be popular, but I think it's important for us to take these debates head on." All right, let's go to a little Hollywood news. This is the HWD section. Without an Oscar nomination, Adam Sandler heads back to Netflix. Last year, the Sandman joked he would purposefully make a movie that's so bad if he were snubbed by the Academy. By Christopher Rosen, published on January 31st. While promoting Uncut Gems last year, Adam Sandler told Howard Stern that if he were to be snubbed by the Academy in the Best Actor category, there would be hell to pay. "If I don't get it, I'm gonna fucking come back and do one again that is so bad on purpose just to make you all pay," he joked. "That's how I get him." Now, weeks after failing to secure a nod, one he deserved, Sandler is primed for his revenge. Netflix announced Friday that the comedy superstar will make 4 additional films for the service, building on a library of Sandler content already housed on the streaming platform. According to Netflix's internal inscrutable metrics, subscribers have spent 2 billion hours with Sandler stuff since the 2015 premiere of The Ridiculous Six. Whether you know him as Sandman, The Waterboy, Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, Nick Spitz, or simply Adam, one thing is clear. Our members can't get enough of him. Ted Sarandos, Netflix chief content officer, said in a press release, "They love his stories and sense of humor, as we saw with Murder Mystery. So I could not be more excited to extend our partnership with Adam and the Happy Madison team and deliver more laughs around the world." Ah, yes, Murder Mystery, Sandler's other 2019 release. According to Netflix, the comedy starring Sandler and Jennifer Aniston was picked by 83 million households in its first 4 weeks. All told, Netflix claims Murder Mystery was the most popular title on the platform last year. Sorry, The Irishman. Sandler has starred in 5 feature films so far for Netflix: The Ridiculous Six, The Do-Over, Sandy Wexler, The Week of, Murder Mystery. He's also made the comedy special 100% Fresh. This year, he'll star alongside a cavalcade of his friends, Kevin James, Tim Meadows, and Rob Schneider among them, in the family comedy Hubby Halloween. Netflix also reports that it has an animated film in the works with Sandler as well. There's even a silver lining for Sandler devotees who found Uncut Gems to be the actor's best performance yet. As noted in the press release, Josh and Benny Safdie's relentless breakout will hit Netflix in May. International subscribers can actually watch Uncut Gems right now. As Sandler once sang, not too shabby. More movie news. Fast and Furious 9 trailer. Vin Diesel stops a car with his bare hands. Plus, Han is back. This is by Johanna Desta, published on January 31st. Welcome to the 9th Fast and Furious film, F9, The Fast Saga. Vin Diesel can stop a flying car with his bare hands, John Cena has turned to the dark side, and Sung Kang, aka Han, is back. Nice clubhouse, he says, casually strolling back into Dom's shop. And heart, of course. Though Han died in The Fast and the Furious, Tokyo Drift, his memory has loomed large in the Fast franchise, with many fans calling for justice for the fallen character. After all this time, it seems like the powers that be have heard their prayers, welcoming Han back into the hashtag family. The new trailer for F9, The Fast Saga, dropped Friday, delivering all of the insane excess we've come to accept from the deliciously absurdist franchise. This time around, the narrative revolves around Dom, played by Diesel, facing off against his brother Jacob, played by a dark-sided Cena. In true Fast fashion, Jacob is an absolute uber-villain, made all the more vicious by his familial ties to Dom. He's a befuddled Roman, Tyrese Gibbs recounts. Played by Tyrese Gibbs recounts, a master thief, an assassin, and a high-performance driver, of course. He's also in cahoots with Cypher, the formerly dreadlocked villain portrayed by Charlize Theron in The Fate of the Furious. Your whole life, you pushed yourself to be faster than Dom, smarter than Dom, but could you kill him? She purrs cruelly, because I'm ready if you are. As with all the Fast movies, F9 is packed with improbable action scenes, including but not limited to one in which Dom stands on top of a speeding car and then gets hit by a nearly flipped car, only to stop it with his bare hands. Somehow. If Idris Elba's villainous Brixton was toying with superhero capabilities in the last film, F9 has evidently decided to throw out the rules and lean all the way into magic. F9, directed by Justin Lin, speeds into theaters on May 9th. Also in movie news, still in the award season, Parasite can't stop winning awards on its way to the Oscars. Bong Joon-ho's masterpiece is collecting more hardware by the day. This is by Johanna Desta, published on January 31st. The Writers Guild Awards are one day away. The BAFTAs are 2 days away, and Oscar voting closes in just 5 days, meaning that we're really truly nearing the end of award season. Perhaps it won't come as a surprise to learn that Parasite, Bong Joon-ho's masterwork, is leading the pack as the run-up to the Academy Awards draws to a close, picking up two key awards at the London Critics Circle Film Awards, a bellwether for how it might fare at Sunday's BAFTAs. Parasite won Film of the Year and Director of the Year from the LCC, edging out its toughest competition, The Irishman, and 1917. But while the London critics selected Oscar frontrunners in several key races, Renee Zellweger for Actress of the Year, Joaquin Phoenix for Actor of the Year, they also gave some duly earned attention to Joanna Hogg's artistic study, The Souvenir. That film, produced by Martin Scorsese's company and released by A24, has had a quiet journey on the stateside circuit. Still, Parasite was the big takeaway from this awards round. While it's still not guaranteed that the film will walk away with Best Picture at this year's Oscar, the tide appears to be rising in its favor. 1917 be damned. In other awards news, film and TV casting directors were honored this week at the 35th Annual Artios Awards, held Thursday night in ceremonies across New York, Los Angeles, and London. In the film space, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, cast by Victoria Thomas, won the Big Budget Drama Award. The movie starred newbies Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, plus future president of Hollywood, Julia Butters, while Knives Out, cast by Mary Verneuil, took the Big Budget Comedy statuette. In the independent space, Marriage Story, which contains the single best casting choice of the year, took the drama prize, while Jojo Rabbit earned the comedy equivalent. The Last Black Man in San Francisco, a Plan B joint, picked up the low budget award. Also happening this week, the Kodak Film Awards, which honor features that were shot on actual film. Stumping his way across the circuit was Quentin Tarantino, who was there Wednesday night to accept the Lifetime Achievement Award. Little Women helmer Greta Gerwig was also in town, accepting the Auteur Award. Her partner, Noah Baumbach, picked up an Auteur Award as well. How nice that their awards can keep each other company on the mantle or bookshelf or wine rack or wherever bookish West Villageites keep their Hollywood hardwire. Let's keep it going in the Oscar category. Taika Waititi on why he made Oscar contender Jojo Rabbit. It felt scary to me. For the actor, writer, director, the movie is not just an anti-war satire inspired by the Holocaust and the Bosnian War, but an exploration of childhood and a tribute to mothers. This is by Taika Waititi, published on January 31st, 2020. Jojo Rabbit is adapted from the book Caging Skies by Christine Lunins, which my mother introduced me to in 2010. At the time, I was getting tired of seeing World War II through the lens of the soldier and began to wonder what the experience was like for ordinary people. Around that time, it was the 20th anniversary of the Bosnian War. As a teenager in 1990, 1991, I had zero knowledge or interest in this conflict, fought in a place I couldn't find on a map, and so it went by without much attention on my part. But in 2010, I decided to educate myself on this part of human history. What I discovered was a series of events and war crimes that matched many of the atrocities committed during the Holocaust, and what really struck me was that the stories focused on the treatment and experiences of children, which is something I'd never really considered. I need to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we are reading exclusively from Vanity Fair Online. We're currently in the HWD section, specifically on Oscar news. And we're reading an article by Taika Waititi, who is the actor, writer, director of Jojo Rabbit, which is an Oscar contender. Let's continue with that article. This idea of how war affects children is what led me to connect on a deeper level with the story and themes in Caging Skies. The idea of trying to understand this little boy, who we should despise, and seeing Nazi Germany fall apart through his eyes, that felt like a challenge, as a way to externalize the battle that is going on in Jojo's head throughout the film, I added the imaginary Hitler character. I've always used humor to present my ideas, and if I were to be true to myself and my sensibilities, this had to be the same. My laughs never come for free. I always knew I was in good company with the great satirists that came and went before me, but it still feels like my boldest film yet. This subject matter is very sensitive, and I knew I had to get it right. Pressure of the risk is the driving force of what keeps me going. That's another reason I made Jojo Rabbit, because it felt scary to me. At this point in my career, I felt I was up for the challenge. Cut to 2020, and Jojo Rabbit now has a resonance that I could never have predicted in 2010. It's shocking and kind of sad to think that a film like this would have even more relevance than ever, but it's also a reminder of just how important these stories are. They're more than films. They're dialogues around the way we treat each other and raise our children. They're a way of educating ourselves, and more importantly, the younger generations, about the dangerous habits of humans and the importance of fighting against intolerance and hate. I specifically chose contemporary dialogue and popular music to convey these messages so the film could further resonate with today's audience. Lastly, the film is a love letter to mothers. My own mother has been an intellectually stimulating and creatively supportive force in my life, so it feels appropriate and natural that the film should focus so much on the influence of Jojo's mother. She is a mother before anything, and knowing how I feel about parenting and the perils it brings, it's particularly satisfying to see Scarlett Johansson create a character whose priority is her son. Rosie's main drive is protecting Jojo from the pervading darkness around them. She encourages her son, through love and laughter, to remain a child, to reject the dangerous ideas threatening his innocence, and stay in the light. I guess that's the aim of the film as a whole, is to allow the good and kindness within us to grow. We seem to need it a lot right now. All right, we're continuing celebrity news, but this is going back to the Grammys. Week in fashion. Who decides what's pink? Or what's a trend? This is by Dan Adler, published on January 31st. After Sunday's Grammy Awards, you'd be forgiven for wondering where all the pink came from. Between the red carpet, his performance, and his acceptance speech for Best Rap Album, Tyler, the Creator, combined pink and red three times over the course of the night. Lil Nas X was in fuchsia Versace on the carpet prior to his own whirlwind, engrossing performance. Without getting too technical about the meaning of the color, it's worth noting that Elle included Shawn Mendes's and Common's pink/red/purple suits in its roundup of how men in pink suits ruled the Grammys red carpet. You might have wondered about all this last week, too, when Esquire UK published a story called Back to the Fuchsia, Why the Pink Power Suit Rules in 2020, cited Timothy Chalamet and Andrew Scott's recent pink on red carpet adventures, as well as Marshalla Ali, Chadwick Boseman, and Nicholas Hoult. Or after the 2019 Oscars, after observing either the suits or dresses on display. This is all to say nothing of the 2017 efforts to define millennial pink. Any of these occasions would be far from the first time pink has had a kind of moment. Paris Hilton's affection for juicy couture and her hot pink Bentley rides circa 2009 come to mind, and certainly something was up with the color by 2004 when Cameron told the New York Times, "When I did pink, I did it so it wouldn't be dressing like everyone else." In 2012, he had worn a pink fur coat and hat and carried a matching phone to Baby Fat's New York Fashion Week show, an image so resonant that it was the basis for Lil Nas X's Halloween costume last year, as well as any number of t-shirts, socks, and shower curtains. In 2017, a Dazed story sought to explain how Cameron's baby pink outfit predicted fashion's future. Upon seeing a pink Range Rover in Manhattan recently, it was still hard to believe that it could be anyone's but his. But cards on the table, I didn't notice that there were multiple pink suits at the Grammys until it was pointed out to me. Not only has pink somewhat gone the way of black and white and navy, but leopard print and tie-dye have been described as neutrals in recent years. Me, personally, I haven't worn pink in about 4 or 5 months, Cameron said in that same Time story, just for the simple fact that everybody's wearing pink. Meanwhile, the question isn't just how to define a trend, but how to define pink. When Jay-Z was asked about his suit at his Roc Nation brunch on Saturday, he insisted that it was not pink, but mauve. A few Grammys from now, there might not be a statement color anymore, just statement color theories. Let's move to some royal news. What Meghan and Harry's exit reveals about the royal family's future. Royal biographer Sally Bedell Smith weighs in on the clues, controversy, and her concerns for Prince Harry as he breaks off from the monarchy. This was published January 24th by Julie Miller. Biographer and former Vanity Fair contributing editor Sally Bedell Smith has been studying the British royal family for over 20 years now, speaking to members of the family's innermost circles, poring over its archives, and tracking the monarchy's evolution, while writing her best-selling biographies on Princess Diana, Queen Elizabeth, and Prince Charles. So on January 8th, when Smith read that Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's announcement that they would be stepping away from the royal family as senior members, released after months of internal discussions, but before the couple had finalized a plan with the crown, Smith was not entirely shocked. "I had been hearing the tom-toms for a while, as early as the autumn of 2018, Bedell told Vanity Fair Thursday by phone, speaking over a cup of tea. "If we look back on it now, we can see the progression of it in the splitting of William and Harry's households, the splitting of the foundation, and in Meghan in particular, her increasing outspokenness and effort to devise her own role. We could see back at the end of their African tour and in that ITV documentary last fall that they were both very unhappy. But there were also details about the decision that surprised and even concerned the royal historian. Ahead, Smith puts this controversial monarchical shift into fascinating historical context, looks back on Meghan's troubled fast-tracking into the royal family, and wonders how the Queen's grandson will fare now that he's chucked the palace's long-laid plans out for him out the window. Sally Bedell Smith. What was so surprising to me was the level of unhappiness and that they decided to leave after less than 2 years of being married. I was in Windsor in May of 2018 for their wedding, and in talking to people close to the royal family, it was clear they really bent over backward to accept Meghan. The way they incorporated an African-American bishop giving the homily at the wedding and had the gospel choir, they had a lot of elements that were very symbolic of the blending of these two very different cultures, and that was the most visible evidence of it. The Queen also bucked tradition by inviting Meghan to spend Christmas 2017 with the royal family, in spite of the fact that Meghan and Harry were not yet married. I thought the biggest thing the Queen did was she saw very wisely that Harry was a huge favorite around the world in places like the West Indies, in Africa, in India, and all the former Commonwealth countries that are former colonies. She gave him three roles in the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth is very near and dear to her heart and one of the most important parts of her legacy. That alone, I think, was an indication of how much she wanted them to have a meaningful role, those Commonwealth titles. I remember thinking that because Meghan's mother was in L.A. and she grew up in L.A., they might spend 2 months in California a year, the way that the Queen spends a few months in the winter in Sandringham and Charles does in Scotland. But I guess what really surprised me was Harry's willingness to leave the royal family and to leave England for all practical purposes. Here's what the Queen's speedy handling of Harry and Meghan's exit says about the monarch. "The Queen's approach to the monarchy is what one of her former private secretaries, Robin Janvrin, wonderfully described as the Marmite theory of monarchy, which is all about evolutionary change. That good old Marmite spread, love it or hate it, has a red, yellow, and green label familiar to everybody. But if you compare the Marmite jar today with one that was on the shelves 50 years ago, you'll see that it's very different. The jar evolved so gradually that nobody really noticed the changes, and the monarchy has changed the same way, very incrementally over time." The Queen has shown that she can modify that approach when she's faced with a big challenge. The death of Diana was a big deal, and she did what she felt she needed to do as a grandmother, which was to take care of William and Harry and prepare them for a big public ordeal of the funeral. But at the same time, she moved very quickly to tell her advisors to come up with a funeral plan that was very much tailored to Diana. As Lord Chamberlain at the time said to me, "We did it in 5 days," and that was the Queen's order. Even though she's had her incremental approach, she is far wiser and more flexible than people give her credit for. She did the same thing after the Panorama interview, during which Diana told Martin Bashir about her husband's infidelity. She moved very, very quickly to ask Diana and Charles to get a divorce. Howe, in spite of reports that Harry felt cut out of the royal family, his long-term role as a royal had been carefully plotted out by the palace with the help of the prince himself. The palace was very mindful of what happened to Prince Andrew, and they didn't want that to happen to Harry. When Charles, Anne, Edward, and Andrew were setting out to do their duties, they all went off on their own. Andrew was in the Navy, he married Fergie, and when he left the Navy, he didn't really have a defined role, and he perhaps lacked the imagination to come up with something himself. So he ricocheted from one thing to another, kind of unsupervised. He got into trouble because he has never been known for having very good judgment. But they set it up so Harry would have a very secure place in the royal family and would have responsibilities and a role and specific interests and passions that he could pursue. Something meaningful for him to do for decades, really, and he was a full participant in mapping all of that out. He was very comfortable with all that. How Charles has been carving out a role for Harry as a senior royal family member since 2012. We also tend to forget that Harry has been an integral part of Charles's plan for a slimmed-down monarchy since 2012, during the Diamond Jubilee. Charles insisted that the only people on the Buckingham Palace balcony be himself and Camilla, William, Kate, and Harry. And if Harry had a wife, she would have been there too. The unfortunate thing about what has happened is that it really blows a hole into Charles's well-thought-out plan for a slimmed-down monarchy based on the core family, because Harry was in fact a very integral part. People say that Harry isn't next in line to the throne, which is true, but what they forget is that George and Charlotte and Louis are not going to be active members of the royal family for 15 or 20 years. So Charles and William have been counting on Harry to be, in effect, third in line to the throne, and that's all out the window, too. Why she believes that Harry and Meghan could have waited to make their announcement, in spite of The Sun having information on the internal split discussions. The Sun had caught wind, but they had fragmented information that was not all that dissimilar from other kinds of things that had leaked out matters in the royal family. It was something they could have easily overrode or put out an anodyne statement from Buckingham Palace saying these roles are always a work in progress to kind of smooth things over. What Harry said on Sunday night was that these discussions had been ongoing, and the Queen said it as well. So clearly they had been trying to respond to whatever it was that Harry and Meghan wanted, and it was really only their jumping the gun with the statements and plans, which were still not fully formed, that precipitated the whole crisis. I think if they had ridden it out, this could have been done in a much more graceful way. Why the Queen's statement was so unusually personal. If you read between the lines of the Queen's statement, the personal nature of them was highly unusual. The Queen's description of Harry as her grandson was one of several uncharacteristically personal touches to her official statement. You could feel that she was very attuned to the fact that Harry in particular, and Meghan, by her own admission, are in a very emotionally vulnerable place. She surely remembers Diana and how emotionally unpredictable she was. This was the Queen's opportunity to show that she is in tune and mindful of the fragility of their situation and their vulnerability. How, in spite of her responsibilities, the Queen had a grandmotherly relationship with Harry. They have spent one-on-one time together, many, many times. After Diana died and the boys were at Eton, that was just down the hill from Windsor Castle, they came up to the palace for tea and she spent a lot of time with both of them. She's at Windsor every weekend and she was able to see them in a relaxed way when she wasn't doing public duties. So yes, she took a very maternal grandmotherly interest in both of them. And also, I think as they all do, tried to imbue in them their responsibilities as members of the royal family and what duty and service are all about. How Harry and Meghan's fast-tracked courtship put Meghan at a serious disadvantage for royal life. William and Kate had 8 years together, and for 2 full years leading up to their engagement, he was very carefully bringing Kate into the royal family. She learned how to shoot and about the country activities they enjoy. When they were at St. Andrews, she spent time in Scotland on the Balmoral estate. She was able to spend some time just sort of absorbing what royal life was like, and the palace began to expose her to the public in a deliberate way. If you look back at the Queen Mother, she spent 2 years transitioning into royal life before marrying George V, and she was a member of the British aristocracy. Her family was descended from royalty, and she knew what the royal family was all about. It still took her 2 years because she understood that in marrying a member of the royal family, and this is true as true today as it was 100 years ago, you would forever put away a whole realm of personal freedom. In entering the royal family, which provides innumerable advantages and perks in exchange for doing official duties and charitable work, you really have to renounce a lot of things that may have meant a lot to you and dedicate yourself to an institution that's 1,000 years old. It may be that Meghan didn't see it in those terms. This is the 21st century, and she was highly unusual compared to other royal wives in having been a successful professional woman who was putting aside that whole part of her life to marry Harry. It seems now that she really regrets having had to give that up, and what she was expected to do in the royal family didn't compare with what she had been accustomed to. Prince Philip had to give up his career in the Navy, and it was a sacrifice for him. He couldn't have gone right up the line and become an admiral because he had great leadership qualities, but he gave that up. He really had to. He was already married, but he knew he would have to. Why Harry might find it hard to go out on his own. That's the thing that I think should be cause for concern, which is what can Harry do? We can envision what Meghan can do. They could set up a production company. She's savvy. She's worked on a TV series. She's worked in movies. She knows how it works. She's smart. She's experienced. But Harry was trained as a helicopter pilot. That's his professional training. He didn't go to college. He could maybe be a motivational speaker. He certainly can speak passionately about the causes he believes in. But unless he's more than a figurehead, I'm not sure that that will be something meaningful. I think it's a real issue for him, what he is professionally capable of doing. Now, look, this is a world where people who have no professional credentials become Instagram influencers. The Kardashians are famous for being famous, but I think Harry's above that. And that's not the sort of thing that would make him feel good or make people feel good about him or the family that he belongs to. What's at stake for Meghan and Harry now? I think their future happiness, their ability to make a living that is commensurate with the style of living to which they've become accustomed, whether they can withstand the scrutiny of the press and the paparazzi, which is going to be much more difficult for them to deal with. They're not going to have the automatic backing of a big institution that can come in hard and say, "This is wrong," and leave them alone. Just what we've seen up in Vancouver with paparazzi photographing Meghan and Archie, all bets are off now. TMZ is just around the corner. There may be some sort of privacy law in British Columbia, but if they live in Toronto or they live in LA, they're going to be much more exposed. And why there's so much less at stake for the royal family. They're going to miss one of the most popular members of the family, but what we've seen this week. I mean, these events were long planned, but you have Kate all over the headlines with her 24-hour campaign for early childhood education. You have William writing an editorial with a former foreign secretary in The Telegraph, William Hague, about conservation and the impact of climate. You have Prince Charles in Davos. You have Camilla in a hospice and promoting her children's family reading program. So in other words, Meghan and Harry are gone, but it's as if nothing had happened. With the exception of their absence, it feels like the monarchy is in full flying under all flags and steaming ahead. Even though everything this week has been programmed 6 months in advance, it's a very sort of vivid demonstration that it's business as usual. The big Meghan mystery that remains. The first tremor of disquiet for me came when she decided to leave her rescue mutt, Bogart, behind in Canada when they got engaged. And the reason I know a little bit more about this and that Bogart has a brother named Otto, and Otto belongs to my son who lives in LA, I'm obsessed with the Bogart story because I think it tells a lot. Bogart is a mutt, as is Otto. They were adopted. Otto and Bogart had one playdate during which Smith's son said that Meghan was perfectly nice and loved Bogart. Then in November of 2017, she only takes her other dog, Guy, who is a purebred beagle, with her to England. Poor Bogart, who, by the way, at the time was only 5, which in dog years is exactly the same age as Megan. He was 35. So unless he was sick, which they didn't say, he was perfectly capable of flying. He still would be today. Now she's back in Canada, and there was a picture of her with Guy and her black lab, and the question is, where is Bogart? Why haven't they been reunited? I mean, I know Meghan and Harry had a little cottage in Kensington Palace, but then they went and adopted a big dog, so that sort of doesn't make sense. But it's sad. I mean, if you looked at her in her former Instagram, it was flooded with images of her and little Guy and Bogart. Here are my adorable fellows. I just miss them so much when I'm away. And now Bogart is in Canada, and so is she, and where's Bogart? My son would be willing to adopt him and bringing him into the fold with his brother. He could be found in Malibu again. The royal relationship that is might be hardest to fix. I think the Queen has been magnanimous enough and understanding enough that she is probably the easiest, but I think Harry has some work to do with his father. Personally, I think the fractures were already there between William and Harry. The question now is, will they be able to repair? You can only hope that they can at least reach some sort of accommodation and renew their affection for each other. They're very different, William and Harry, but they've always been so compatible. Different temperaments, different personalities, but they have an incredible shared experience. They're going to need to spend some quality time together. It's not easy to do at such a distance. You've got an ocean and a continent separating them, and FaceTime really isn't going to do it. Here we're going to move now to the Levin Report, published on January 31st. Republicans vote to silence impeachment witnesses, fast-track Trump's acquittal. In the words of Marco Rubio, just because the president has committed an impeachable offense doesn't mean he should be impeached. On Friday night, lawmakers voted on the issue of allowing further evidence in the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. As there were no doctors on hand to perform emergency spinal cord transplants, Republicans defeated the attempt to introduce relevant witnesses and documents, 51-49, with just Mitt Romney and Susan Collins voting with Democrats. That's obviously a sad and depressing outcome, but in the long run, probably just sped up the inevitable, i.e., Republicans acquitting the president and paving the way for him to continue abusing his power for the next 1 to 5 years. And rather than attempt to make the case that Trump did nothing wrong, and that's why they're trying to wrap this thing up ASAP, GOP lawmakers are just coming out and saying it. He did it, and we don't care. And that's not some biased liberal media interpretation of what they've said. Those are the actual words coming out of their mouths. In a Medium post entitled "My Statement on the President's Impeachment Trial," Marco Rubio writes, "Voting to find the president guilty would not just be a condemnation of his action. If I vote guilty, I will be voting to remove a president from office for the first time in the 243-year history of our republic. When they decided to include impeachment in the Constitution, the framers understood how disruptive and traumatic it would be. As Alexander Hamilton warned, impeachment will, quote, agitate the passions of the whole community. This is why they decided to require the support of 2/3 of the Senate to remove a president. We serve as a guardrail against partisan impeachment and against removal of a president without broad public support. Leaders in both parties previously recognized that impeachment must be bipartisan and must enjoy broad public support. In fact, as recently as March of last year, manager Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, said there would be, quote, little to be gained by putting the country through the wrenching experience of a partisan impeachment. And yet only a few months later, a partisan impeachment is exactly what the House produced. Rubio doesn't note that as of March 2019, we didn't know about the president's alleged attempt to extort Ukraine for his personal gain, but we digress. He continues, "The sole purpose of this extraordinary power to remove one person entrusted with all of the powers of an entire branch of government is to provide a last resort remedy to protect the country. That is why Hamilton wrote that in these trials, our decisions should be pursuing the public good. That is why 6 weeks ago I announced that for me, the question would not just be whether the president's actions were wrong, but ultimately whether what he did was removable. The two are not the same. Just because his actions meet a standard of impeachment does not mean it is in the best interest of the country to remove a president from office." Emphasis ours because what the hell? Incredibly, the senator from Florida thought that this argument was so airtight that not only should he memorialize it online, but he should read it out loud while semi-dramatic music plays in the background. Then they have a video. The statement from Rubio, whose loyalty to Trump was never in question, follows an equally cringeworthy explanation from Senator Lisa Murkowski on why she decided not to vote to hear from witnesses, which is basically that the House's process was flawed, and she thought about fixing it, but ultimately decided, I'd rather not. The House chose to send articles of impeachment that are rushed and flawed. I carefully considered the need for additional witnesses and documents to cure the shortcomings of its process, but ultimately decided that I will vote against considering motions to subpoena, the Alaska Republicans said in a statement. In related news, on Friday, the New York Times reported that, per John Bolton's book, the one the White House is trying to stop from being published in its current form, Trump was directing his staff to put the heat on Ukraine months earlier than previously thought. Quote, more than 2 months before he asked Ukraine's president to investigate his political opponents, President Trump directed John R. Bolton, then his national security advisor, to help with this pressure campaign to extract damaging information on Democrats from Ukrainian officials, according to an unpublished manuscript by Mr. Bolton. Mr. Trump gave the instruction, Mr. Bolton wrote, during an Oval Office conversation in early May that included the acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, the president's personal lawyer, Rudolph W. Giuliani, and the White House counsel, Pat A. Cipollone, who is now leading the president's impeachment defense. Mr. Trump told Mr. Bolton to call Volodymyr Zelensky, who had recently won election as president of Ukraine, to ensure Mr. Zelensky would meet with Mr. Giuliani, who was planning a trip to Ukraine to discuss the investigations that the president sought, in Mr. Bolton's account. Mr. Bolton never made the call, he wrote. The previous undisclosed directive that Mr. Bolton describes would be the earliest known instance of Mr. Trump seeking to harness the power of the United States government to advance his pressure campaign against Ukraine, as he later did on the July call with Mr. Zelensky that triggered a whistleblower complaint and impeachment proceedings. But apparently that information is neither here nor there. This brings us to the end of our time together. I thank you for joining me on the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. I thank you for tuning in, and I invite you to join me next week. Hopefully, we will have that brand new issue of Vanity Fair magazine. And remember, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Simply go to sunsounds.org, click broadcast info and audio. Thank you so much for tuning in and have a great week.